Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
I'm Dan Glickberg from Fairway Market with another useful Thanksgiving tip. If you're buying your turkey early, make sure you store it on the bottom shelf in the back of your fridge. That'll keep it cool enough until the big day. For more Thanksgiving tips, log on to fairwaymarket.com.
We are burning down the house here on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Another episode here on the 20th of November, 2011. Today I want to talk about the intersection between art, architecture, and the sustainable world. My guest today is architect and artist Berardo Matalucci, also known as B. Ciao, signore.
Hello. Hello.
Hi. Yes. Welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Come a little closer. Okay, good. Berardo is one of the principals of a group practice, Eco Materico. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah.
The world's foremost environmental assessment. No, that's BREEAM. Wait, you are. Was founded in 2007 as a system of. I got this from your website. Of competencies oriented towards an architecture driven by the symbiosis of people and nature. I'm all for that. That's what I do. Its main vocation has been to stimulate and reactivate natural and artificial ecosystems, integrating design, analytical, and manufacturing attitudes. Its work has been recognized in various international competitions. That's splendid. So in no particular order, B, these are the things I'd like to talk about today. How much architecture are you doing these days, and how much environmental design? How you came to have this group practice with your colleagues, what direction you see taking your practice, where is this going, what is this going to do to make the world a better place, we suppose a better place, and then after that, you know, whatever ideas come up that bear some further conversation. Like, for example, the United Kingdom's own version of LEED, the BREEAM system, which people in the United States may not know about, but which has been applied to significantly, I think, more buildings worldwide than the USGBC's green system. And you can tell us perhaps what the differences or similarities are between BREEAM and LEED. So that'll give you some things to think about. Jack, let's have a brief musical break. Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne with Barada Matalucci, an architect. So, you've been up to all sorts of interesting things, investigating architecture, sustainability, and technology.
Yes.
Yes. What's your special interest when it comes to technology?
I believe that in a certain way, technology is providing at these days, let's say, the possibility of integrating knowledge and assets throughout in a very, very simple way. It is true also that technology are providing us with simple tools that allow us to acknowledge or to create an enormous amount of program, in a certain way, connections. We can think about the use of the iPhone or mobile devices, and ending throughout the, let's say, the broader connection that the internet is. It is.
So information technology as a tool to help make decisions?
To be aware of.
To be aware. Uh-huh. So how have you been attempting to use these technologies in your work?
In our work, we try to use this technology in order to try to think how architecture can program the space, let's say, can reprogram its direction throughout technology. That doesn't mean to use maybe a refrigerator that is smart, but just try to understand how this technology can inform new kind of spaces.
I can't imagine how that works. I mean, new kind of space that's informed by more information.
Yes, in a certain way. It could be that by the fact that, for instance, by allowing space to assert a certain amount of program, you give, let's say, the property to the space itself of being flexible enough to host these programs.
That's very interesting. There's a big overlap with what you're talking about, with direction of inquiry that I just heard about last week. There was a panel discussion at the German consulate to the United Nations, and the Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft, the German research agency of the Federal Republic of Germany, has funded research into cognitive awareness of architectural spaces. They're looking at how architecture works or doesn't work from a cognitive point of view, where people get lost because the architecture doesn't give us an indication of how to use the space, how to move through the space, if you therefore have to rely on signs, or they call it wayfinding, which is a fancy word for signage. Either architectural gestures of indication of, well, we go from here to here to here, or having to hang signs saying, here's this, here's that. It was very interesting because one of the speakers was talking about how this wired world of information could inform designers' decisions about how to make space. So I think that you're talking about the same thing.
Yes, it's true. In a certain way, I like every time to think about the Japanese way of building the traditional houses in the history. They basically were placing nodes of primary sources that were actually the fireplace or openings or capability of gathering or people or flows or... Mm-hmm. Opening and closing space, but they are, or I don't know, maybe they were just placing in a precise point of the house places where you can store your clothes or store your goods or I don't mm-hmm. know, prepare food. But they were not giving any other direction or any other suggestion how to organize the space inside the house.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, this kind of houses or settlement were, yeah, development where you, in the winter season, you were close to the fireplace simply because of thermal needs. Mm-hmm. But during the summer, you were more close to the open spaces, and mm-hmm. so you could use or could experience the being of part of the landscape. That's why I started to think that probably some, I mean, at this point we are probably constrained. We are constraining in a certain way the distribution of our spaces in order to function in only one way or a couple of ways.
Hmm. That's a very interesting idea that the received notions of modern space require space to be used only in one kind of way, because our buildings don't have windows that open sometimes.
Yes.
So what do you do about that? What are you doing about that? How are you solving this quandary?
I don't think that we are solving these quandaries, but we are trying to investigate if maybe it's possible to switch or to introduce a new kind of let's say, way of thinking about spaces that probably is more related to negotiation or intercorrelation between programs in the space. I mean, rather than thinking a living room or a kitchen or a bathroom, we can maybe try to understand the needs of resting, the needs of eating, and the need of washing or, I don't know, be clean.
So to focus on a function of life instead of relying on received notions of a living room has a television
sofa.
Set and a sofa. Yes.
Yes, it's true.
Yes, and an area rug. Right. But rather, what is the nature of a living room? Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, it's an asset of program, of function, let's say, that are confined within the space. But
yes, I understand. Yeah, so that space making is a response to the various parts of human existence, as you say, sleeping, washing, eating, cooking,
working, I don't know, meeting people.
Yes,
or
right.
It's probably a list of eventual programs that can be extended or can be compressed according to the needs of everyone.
Interesting.
Or the family.
Interesting. Let me think about this a little bit. In your honor, I went through YouTube looking for recently popular pop songs from Italy. So let's have a couple minutes of suspended life, I think is what it means.
Okay.
Vivo sospesa tra sogni e quotidianità. Io m'ero persa per strade sconosciute, già cambiate prima di arrivare. Nel mio percorso speranze e possibilità, nei nuovi giorni la vita si trasformerà. Cambiando i miei giorni, prendendo i miei sogni.
Okay, my Italian guest had no idea who that was, and actually my Italian's not good for me to be able to tell you. But it gave me some time to think. What I understand you to be saying, B, is that you're exploring what it's like to have the form follow the function of the activity rather than the use of a space have to conform to a culturally predetermined, a bedroom is like this, a living room is like this, a kitchen must be like this, to look more at the functions themselves and let the functions suggest what the form might be like.
I think that in a certain way is an informal negotiation between the two parts. It's true that forms is extremely important as well as function, and it is extremely important to understand which are the function or the program inside a space. And I think at the end it's a sort of deal that...
A compromise?
Yeah, compromise.
Well, what... It's inevitable we have to get around to this question. So what do these compromises look like?
This compromise, I think it's look like... Every time I think yes, or it's on, let's say, individual response... I'm bringing just one example. One of my partner is working on the rehabilitation of ancient settlement, ancient houses, old houses in the south of Italy, and he's confronting with the problem of reprogramming those spaces according to the needs of the new people, the mm-hmm. new clients that mm-hmm. are going to live inside that space.
Uh-huh.
Of course, the architecture there was that building were conforming in order to work primarily as a sort of agricultural, urban, agricultural farming typology. So
yeah.
people were living and working and cropping their food there,
yes.
producing energy, recycling, but mainly this huge world that was related with agriculture.
Yeah.
But now he has to confront with the needs of people who are visitors or who are tourists or living there just for a couple of seasons or only during the summer season.
Sure, sure, sure. Right. Visitors for agroturismo do not want to sleep above the pigs.
Yes.
For example.
Yes.
I mean, we suppose they don't want to, but perhaps some might, but but many, many others might not.
Yes, it's true.
So reprogramming what's already been there, that sounds very exciting and difficult.
Yes, extremely difficult. In his way, for instance, the form is already established. So he has to, in a certain way, negotiate the function and or try to understand or design this new way of reprogramming the space. And so, for sure, in this example, form is dominant. While mm-hmm. the function should be compromised or in a certain way should deal.
Sure. I myself am no stranger to the notion of multifunctional space. In my apartment in Manhattan, the kitchen is really just a recess in the wall of the so-called living room. So there's no space to do preparation. So I have a nice, simple wooden table. So preparation comes out from the fixtures and happens on the table, and the cooking happens between the niche and the table, and then the food is served on the table because then the cooking stuff goes away. You can sit at the table and talk after you've eaten. Or you can sit at the table and read, so then the table also becomes the library, so to speak. But I do have a sofa. But the sofa, you know, it's in the space, and it doesn't bother me that I can see the table and around the corner, the niche with the cooking stuff, because it's the living space, you know, it's not the quiet space. So this notion of multi-purpose enclosure is something I'm no stranger to. It would be nice if I could move the walls, but that's not possible. Not in the confines of a very modest-sized apartment.
It's not possible to move walls, but of course not the perimeter walls.
Right.
We are all in a system where actually the kind of properties that we have is confined throughout borders.
Sure.
So of course, I mean, what
but
we
then the question is how do we define the space within that border?
Yes.
And there are of course many ways of making a space within a space through light, through the placement of objects. Even here in this studio, there are, in fact, several rooms. Here's the foyer here.
Yeah.
Here we have the living room, although it could also be the dining room if you bring the pizza in. Over there, in that end, that's another room. That's the DJ's setup over there. And it's as if it's a separate room. It just doesn't happen to be walls in between here and there. But there are really different zones of one space, and they're really quite different.
Yes.
Different not only because of the arrangement of furniture, but also variations in light. Here there's a gathering of light. There in the entrance areas are a little bit darker. And so it's a modulation of space, even within the very small confines of these two 9 foot by 22 foot or so shipping containers that we are in here that make our studio.
But not, I mean, you are also free to reassess the space according to other needs. I mean,
sure.
If you have, if you're going to invite 7-8 guests, you're mainly probably...
Well, when we have that many guests in here, it becomes just simply very intimate. And then it's more like the rabbit hutch.
Yeah.
With bunnies piled up everywhere. Let's switch gears a little bit and go back to art and technology. You did mention that you're working on a super secret project that you can't really talk about too much. But perhaps there's other less secret projects that you can talk about. I did look at the different variations of your website. You've got Echo Materico SDR, and then you've got Echo Materico Design. On one or the other, there were posts on the blog post playing with Arduino circuits or something like that.
Yes, it's true.
Do you do that?
I started to do, and then I stopped for a while. New York.
That's well, yeah. We have many projects, and the projects start and they stop, and then we pick them up.
But one of my partner in London is working also, especially with Arduino,
uh-huh.
And he is mainly the director of the SDR part, which means sustainable design research.
Yes.
And he is a researcher at the University of Cardiff, and he's focusing on tools and technology for sustainability.
Yeah, a lot of my friends and listeners will not know what the heck we're talking about an Arduino. I myself am a bit of a gearhead, and I did a lot of electronics when I was younger. So an Arduino is a multi-purpose circuit board. Has all kinds of different possibilities of what you can. It's basically a controller. It's
yes,
a smart
yes,
controller.
Yes.
Yeah. So you can set it up to be an alarm clock. You can use it in micro robotics.
A fan. Arduino basically has two interfaces. One is analogic, and the other one is digital. So it's throughout these two canals you can control a clock, you can control an oven, you can control a stereo, or you can control digital.
Right. We could use an Arduino to open the door to the studio.
Yes.
Sure.
Yes.
By putting some sort of sensor on the outside, and then run it as an actuator for a motor to open the door, and you can also gang them up to do things. So it's a worldwide movement of how do we use this circuit. And I think it's very interesting and, for me, heartwarming that other people who have architectural backgrounds are also playing with real technology. I notice from your resume that's on LinkedIn, I do my research, that your first degree was in engineering and architecture.
Yes, that's
right. At Aquila.
Yes.
So how much engineering do they teach there?
When I was studying there, when I graduated in 2003, the aim of the school was to try to combine as much engineering as possible with architecture. The idea was to try to give us a sense of structure and technology that are behind every architecture, but also giving us the idea of how to make architecture, how to design architecture, how to conceive architecture. So there were courses that were focusing mainly in structure or physics or thermic or electrical.
Good.
And other that were purely studios, that were just design proposal. And it was mainly up to the student to try to establish those, let's say, interconnections between the technological architecture.
I think always it has to be.
Yes.
It's up to us to decide how we synthesize our learning. So yourself, did you get any electronic engineering instruction?
No, I didn't educate myself. I was mainly oriented on architecture and design principles. But I found it very, very, very useful after some years, I realized, to have an understanding of what the meaning of controlling, scientifically controlling, I don't know, thermal heating or therms or electricity and lighting, so or structure itself. But I mainly oriented myself toward design. But some of the students I was studying with mainly took the path of technical engineering, specializing in, I don't know, thermal heating or in AC control or AC systems or structure.
Yeah, understood. You yourself, how did you get into the Arduino world?
I entered in Arduino when I was, I started to, let's say, understand Arduino when I was studying in the IAC in Barcelona.
That came after Aquila.
That came after, yes, 2007. And there they were, let's say we were thrown into a common space and a lot of students with different backgrounds, let's say, started to meet one each other after one day, and then we stick together for 1 year studying, and of course we try to speculate or try to understand. Everyone was apporting his knowledge to this kind of common container that was the common knowledge container.
And common knowledge container. That's what they called the school?
No, they called the school Institute of Advanced Architecture.
No, but the concept for the school was that it was a common knowledge container. I think that's lovely.
I will propose to the director of the...
No, that's like being part of the Matrix, but nicer.
Yeah, but in a certain way it was like this. We were, we had our desk... And actually, we're common desk, and we had to share spaces, and we had to share space to draw or laser cut or tools.
Sure. So if you're sharing desk space with an electronic engineer, you're going to learn about what they're doing. They're going to learn about what you're doing.
Yeah,
that's a great idea.
Yeah, actually, they were mainly architects, but they had different backgrounds. So and they were also engineering who were studying there, and so they were supporting with this knowledge of electronic or structure, what's going on. But everything was oriented toward the sustainability approach. So actually we had a common focus or common intent.
Well, different people believe have different ideas about what sustainability really means.
Yes, I would say also they have different vocabulary.
Aha, Yes.
And I mean, sometimes the word, I don't know, sustainability or, yeah, sustainability or design means something to someone or something to someone else.
Let's take another little break and reframe our thoughts, come back, talk about sustainability a little bit. And I'm going to smoke a happy cigarette. Burning down the house, talking about this, that, and the other thing related to art, technology, sustainability with Berardo Matalucci, who's an architect and a technologist, and I'm so happy that you're here.
Thank you.
Now, in North America, when we think about sustainability, we think about the forests that we have, and we think about using lots of wood, because we can grow more if we use it up. Europe's a little different. Except maybe for Poland. What does sustainability mean in southern Italy, for example?
Sustainability in Italy probably will mean that we can try to, in a certain way, at the moment in Italy there is this huge attention toward reduce energy consumption. So I think, and try, yes, in a certain way, is that, and try so to limitate the consumption of buildings, not as only as the energy that they have to use in order to function, but also the energy that they need in order to be built.
Okay.
And if we just address everything to energy, we can say that the source of the material that we use for buildings needs a certain amount of energy in order to be produced,
correct,
or in order to be installed, or in order to be maintained.
Right. Well, you have all the famous quarries, you know, up and down the whole country. We don't, here in the United States, do not have as much of a culture of building with stone. On the other hand, there's a certain amount here of emotional reaction against concrete. Now, your people invented concrete.
Yes,
thousands true. Of years ago. The way that we make concrete now is quite different than 2,000 years ago. We're not about to go back to sort of the Bronze Age method of making concrete. But we do look at the energy inherent in the materials that we use, and will these materials last a good long time? So I'm understanding that's a big focus for you in Italy.
Yes, at the moment it is.
Yeah.
Yes.
And of course, everyone's trying to conserve energy. The Germans have taken it to the extreme with Dr. Feist and Passive House, houses with so much insulation that if you turn on a gas stove, everyone's going to have to start stripping down like it's a sauna, because also another aspect of the passive house is that there's very little air changed, which in the United States would be illegal because we have standards of how many changes of air, which is order of magnitudes higher than what passive house requires. Is there any interest in Italy? I'm asking because I don't know. In this super insulated kind of construction, say, up in the north, like in Ticino, where it's much colder?
Yes, especially in, of course, as you know, probably Italy has two main climates.
Right.
Condition. One is the one close with the Alpe. And
right.
Alps,
the Alpine
yes.
climate.
And the other one is the southern climate.
Right.
So when we are in that condition, so in the southern, it's almost impossible or insane to think about passive systems.
Right.
Simply because the sun is so hot and that is impossible to govern. The passive house can work for the alpine climates.
Yeah.
And of course the super insulation
yeah.
is extremely welcome, especially in the Ticino region.
Yeah.
Where they were almost the pioneer of the development. They were the pioneer of the sustainable thoughts.
Right. Well, that's practically almost Switzerland up
yes.
there. Right.
But in the south of Italy, the center and south of Italy, we have to think new. Or we have to read throughout our culture in making buildings
yes.
that were using mass and insulation.
Yes. Or mass and shading.
And shading, yeah.
Right. I mean, people go and they look at the Colosseum and they don't realize that the ancients had huge awnings and canopies to keep the sun. Yeah. Which have not survived because it was canvas, cloth, and it's just gone. Or... after people abandoned Rome, other people came in and just took it down and used it for something else. Yes,
yes.
That's a possibility.
And honestly, I mean, if we also consider there is another example of that I think is one of probably the most important according to multiplicity of thoughts, it's Matera, that is in the south of Italy, is actually is UNESCO World Heritage and is part of the city that is called Matera.
Uh-huh.
And actually it's an extremely compact and dense settlement where each apartment, each dwelling is just opposed, is placed one on top of the other. And so in a certain way the shadows and the reaction with the insulation is negotiated throughout the a social distribution of the town itself.
Mm-hmm. That's very exciting. So the pieces
actually
as they're arranged work to shade other parts and I suppose catch breezes.
Yes. And if we think about this, the notion of property is completely inverted. Actually, it's not that I own a piece of land and from the ground above to the sky is mine, but I own just a piece of space.
Uh-huh.
And so maybe I share
uh-huh. yeah.
I share my roof with someone else,
uh-huh.
or I share my right wall or my southern wall
right.
with someone else.
And my floor is somebody else's roof.
Yes. Or yes.
Yes.
Or I have stairs that goes down and I share some of the pieces of my dwelling with somebody else. It's in a certain way creating what's called program intercorrelation.
Yes. That is a totally different program. Well, an apartment house in any big city is like that, except that our modern apartments stack, one above the next. There's no geometric complexity. And I suppose that Matera grew over many, many hundreds of years and was adjusted
yes.
to work with the environment. and it works. Yes.
Yes, it works. I think it's a great example. The thing is that with the modern, we have constraints that comes with the law.
Yes.
And actually, the law is telling us that we have to do spaces, or we have to arrange spaces according to spatial distribution rather than correlation. It's impossible at the moment with the current legislation or the current law to reproduce the things that were made with Matera or with Fez in Morocco or in every kind of compact city that was.
To a lesser extent, New Yorkers who may be listening are probably more familiar with Positano or one of those Amalfi Coast cities that climbs up the cliffs.
It's the same, yeah.
Similar. Or further up the coast to Cinque Terre.
Yes.
With the geometrically rich assemblages of places to live. So that gives us an idea for what a new architecture might be. Not necessarily what you're investigating, but things that are there as an example from history. Here in the United States and in parts of Northern Europe, we've been looking at ancient Persian construction, where they use a central, almost like a chimney, to draw hot air out in the summertime so that it's naturally ventilating, to get away from the enormous electrical demands of air conditioning. And I think that has a lot of potential.
Yes.
So back to the question of, in your own work, what do these things look like? You say that they're flexible and they can be used in different ways. Are we talking about buildings that look like butterflies or a pile of melting ice cubes? Or give us an idea of what's it like?
I think it's more or less like the things that we are used to see around. I mean, I don't believe that the answer to this kind of thoughts should be found in buildings that have to move or have to fly or have to be blob or have to be sponges. But maybe it could be addressed to how we really locate program inside the space. Is it possible to condensate certain amount of functions and then to give possibility of flexibility to other space? I mean, it's obvious that we have to cook, it's obvious that we have to use kitchens, and it's obvious that we have to use bathroom or restroom.
Oh, so this gets back to your talking about Japanese space, where there are sliding panels. So you're a fan of sliding panels, perhaps?
It's a very good option. Uh-huh. See, because it makes you think which wall is important and which wall is not so important.
I never thought of hierarchies of walls before. That's good. That's something to consider. I meant especially in Japanese traditional consists, like for example, the palace at Katsura.
Yeah.
I don't think of some walls being principally always in that position and others moving, but I suppose, because I'm not a great student of that building, that there is a hierarchy of wall.
There is an hierarchy of, I think, spaces.
Spaces, yeah.
So spaces that are defined by this wall. So according to the closing or opening of these spaces, there is a generation of
different proportions.
Yes.
Of enclosed space.
Yes.
Open up something and suddenly you have a great hall, close it up and you have a lot of sleeping rooms, perhaps.
Yes, but again, it's a compromise between what we see in the past and what we have to introduce according to our needs. It's true that, I mean, we have to confront our current needs, the present needs of living our contemporary that means using kitchen, bathroom, etc., and sleeping and having a sleeping bed rather than a mattress on the floor.
Right. Well, I tried living like that for a while with a very small space, and I slept in the Japanese style with a futon that lived rolled up and lived in the closet so that I could have a living room in between. It was very strange, I have to say. But it was for a period of time. It was an interesting experiment. It wasn't impossible. It was certainly economical, because I had less space to have to pay rent on. But it was certainly not an experience that I would recommend to a family.
Yes, true.
It was just me, and it was very small studio space. This is a long time ago. But when I was younger and more spry, and I could do all this moving stuff around. But it's true. There's a certain way that we like to live now, but we don't know for sure what the future brings. I mean, over time, especially we see this in New York, there are certain social classes of people who don't cook. I mean, there are many, tend to be younger people. They don't have families. They don't use their kitchens. They don't need a kitchen. They eat out, or they get food and they take it home and they sit on the sofa, watch TV and eat and just discard the disposable utensils. But for them, there is no accommodation for the fact that they don't need the kitchen. So they might just use the kitchen as an extra closet, or park the bicycle in there or something like that. Maybe they might use the refrigerator to keep beverages, but that's a different kind of way of life as compared with what was the received notion of how to live in decades or centuries past. So your goal is to research how space might be more universal and adaptable then?
Yes, it's true. Uh-huh. I mean,
does it mean then in the work that you would be designing that the walls might move?
Could be an option. Yes, why not? Uh-huh. Walls could become movable, or kitchen. You can share kitchens. Ah. Kitchen could be shared.
Yeah.
Or some sort of spaces could be shared. Sort of other spaces couldn't.
Yeah, that gives me an idea, Jack. Let's just have that little scherzo for a minute and a half and come back. Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, here with Berardo Montalucci. You just mentioned sharing kitchens. This gets into an interest of mine that I very much would like to pursue in the years ahead. The notion of collaborative housing, where groups of people might have their own private spaces, but then share other communal facilities, like communal kitchens, like communal living rooms, communal salons. There are a few of these experiments that have been done, one or two in the United States. There's one in particular up in Upper New England where an entire village is organized, but each individual, let's call it a house, some are larger than others, doesn't have a living room, per se, doesn't have much more of a kitchen than a refrigerator and a coffee maker, that the main meals are, people actually, they leave their house and they walk to a building where everyone cooks together, where there's always food, and the community takes turns creating the food, and then there's always leftovers, and so the kids always have snacks after school, and it's not junk food snacks, because these people are sufficiently like-minded that they don't get that, they don't buy that stuff. They make their own snacks, and necessarily people have to walk more, because they're not just in their house all by themselves. They have to go out if they want to watch TV. They go into the community hall where there are different corners watching different TV shows. They really want to be alone. They can be in their sleeping space with some electronics or something like that. But the idea of gathering is more than just within your family, which then allows people who are older and their children have moved, grown up, and gone away to be part of a community. And I see real potential for that, of collaborative housing, with the right kind of like-minded people, being a wonderful direction for the future.
Yes, this is extremely important in the sense that responsibility should be something that sharing or community development should, in a certain way, not only achieve, but also increment or improve, in the sense that whenever you, it's not that you are taken from your location, then you move to this kind of dwellings or community houses.
You would arrive there out of your own will. It's not like what we do in the United States now with the older people is we pack them up and we send them to a warehouse for old folks where they're fed and they're watered and they're cleaned up, but they're just sort of warehoused. They're not, you know, the old person's housing is a very, to me, unsatisfactory solution, because you have a whole community of old people. There's no young people.
It's happening the same in Italy.
I think it's exceptionally unhealthy for younger people not to see older people around, which is one of the great things about cities, because you have the young and the old, and the wealthy and the poor, and the ailing and the very fit all together, seeing that everyone's not just like you, which is also one of the sicknesses of, to my mind, of the American suburban experiment, where each town is all alike, it's all homogenous.
Yes, I remember that when I was young, or also especially when I was studying in Barcelona, where I think that's probably
in the container of yes, knowledge.
Yes.
Yes, the hothouse of intellectual activity.
Yeah, I experimented two things actually in Barcelona. The one was looking at the life that was happening in the cities, where old people were sitting on the bench close to young guys, and they were playing they were talking and they were dealing in a certain way. They were integrating one each other. And the other and that was fabulous. I think that in no other place like probably Barcelona, I saw this kind of integration that was happening throughout all the levels of society, not only the rich and the poor, but the young and old people, or the educated and uneducated people, or different nationalities, people from Italy or people from South Africa. They were integrating, and there was an interest by the municipality of Barcelona to make that these things really happening. And they wanted to integrate this kind of different social input the city was having throughout history, and to try to create a deep and social integration rather than segregation. It was embedded in the program of the mayor and the municipality itself. The other thing that was happening during my living in my time in Barcelona was that when we started our master's degree in the IAC, in this kind of sort of container, we found out it was in a industrial building that was converted as a school, so with a very high ceiling, and we found that it was a kitchen, a huge kitchen that was left and unused since the first day. And we ended up the master program after 1 year, where we were making food and we were spending time together, even if we were working in different projects, or even if someone was busy, and or even with the technician, or even if with the cleaning lady that was over there. And so we ended up, I mean, we made the dinner, the having lunch, the experiencing lunch, a social moment of, or an educational moment. We were studying, so it was mainly an educational moment.
I understand it completely. When I was in college, we had a farm that belonged to the school where we would go over long weekends. People who were artists, architects, engineers, and all the distinctions evaporated because we would all cook together and we would eat together, and we would then go out in the landscape and walk around, mess around, and so forth. Outside of our academic partitioning by specialty. So this, to complete the circle, using the information that we have and a better understanding of resources and opportunities helps us tear down the walls and then reintegrate through program, through social consciousness raising, a way of life that in fact is very ancient. So we can learn from an old models of organization that are no longer supported by the legal structures, but we can also then, with this information, help to reform the legal social contract to tear down the walls and reintegrate all different kinds of people.
Yeah.
Excellent. I think we've come to our end of our time. This is Curtis B. Wayne on Burning Down the House with Berardo Matalucci. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Curtis.
For having come. I hope you come back soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.